RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Always look forward to our regular Thursday feature, Money Talks, and the contributors that we have on Money Talks. And this morning we're welcoming back Simon Angelo of Wealth Morning, Chief Executive Officer and Publisher at Wealth Morning. He's been investing in markets since he was 17, and he's probably been up all night at the trading desk again. But he's here for us this morning.
Yeah, there are a few late ones in this business, Paul. Great to be back with you.
You're looking pretty chipper, considering. All right. I think the first thing we probably need to talk about, I need to ask you about, is your reaction to the New Zealand First. Well, it's not their idea. Plenty of countries have had sovereign wealth funds, but a $100 billion fund kind of like that for infrastructure and projects of national scale, intergenerational, going forward. And I'm wondering if you think that's a good idea.
I do think it's a good idea, Paul. My first exposure to it was I heard about it from the New Zealand First Conference.
Yeah.
And I went scratching around for some news reports. And the first one I stumbled across was a Radio New Zealand report saying that he would be up against some tricky allies to get it across. And I read the news piece, and by the end of it, I thought another ship was about to sink, that this could tear apart the government, that he'd never get it to work, and there were issues with debt and the coalition partners. And then I realised, well, Simon, you're not 4 years old. You might be being gaslit here. What are the actual facts?
Maybe. Yeah, okay. All right, well, yeah, they would say that, okay? They would say that.
Well, I tell you what, they gave me an idea on how we could seed this future fund.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Sell them. Sell Radio New Zealand, if you can. And even if you can't, I don't know what their budget is, probably 50 million a year.
No, 70. 70.
70.
It's gone up double since I was there 5 years ago.
Well, 5 years of that, there's 350 mil to seed your future fund right there.
Right.
And taxpayers don't have to pay for left-wing biased anymore, and we can start investing in infrastructure.
Where do you get the money, though? Is that a huge amount of money?
Well, the COVID Response and Recovery Fund ended up at 60 billion. So we can definitely produce
a couple of years worth there. Yeah.
Yeah, that is several years worth there. But we can definitely produce that sort of money because we've already spent it. And a lot of it's already gone on Crown debt. But we spent $60 billion on lockdowns that went on too long, supporting people through that, when we could have had a couple of new harbour crossings.
You think about that.
Or 120,000 houses. Never had a housing crisis in this country again. But we didn't invest. The money was just spent. And that's the problem with debt. In the right hands, it can be powerful. In the wrong hands, it can be like a car without brakes.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're thinking of like harbour crossings and power stations or power generating facilities and things at a national infrastructure scale that are paid down well over time. I'm thinking of the tolls on the harbour bridge. Didn't last forever, but it paid it down.
Yeah, you're right. Well, this is what I like about the idea as an investor. The problem in New Zealand is you have this three-year electoral cycle and projects get chopped and changed, whereas this would actually be a bipartisan fund which would work like the New Zealand Super Fund, which I understand has about 70 or 80 billion in it already and is going to insulate our retirement needs as we go forward. So I think to have a bipartisan fund like this makes a huge amount of sense. Now, I'm an investor in Infratil, which is listed on the NZX. It's probably one of my largest holdings. It's up 150% over the last 5 years. And they have actually done some co-investments with the New Zealand Super Fund. So you asked where the money comes from. When you have these sorts of high-quality infrastructure investments to be done in a solid country like New Zealand, you can bring in other partners. So Infratil's invested alongside as a co-investor with the New Zealand Super Fund and Long Road Energy, Retire Australia, So it's those sort of opportunities that this opens.
So you don't go borrowing to support it?
Well, there's a lack of details at the moment. I've been on New Zealand First website. I can't see a policy paper on it. It's just an idea that they've been working on. But I think the intention is actually just to build up a fund, to seed it, and then you can draw in a variety of funding from that, from both the public and private sector. I mean, it's worked, as Winston Peters has said, Singapore has a similar sort of fund, so does Ireland. I would say with Ireland, though, they also have a corporate tax rate at 12.5%, which has attracted in a huge amount of foreign investment from companies wanting to base their European operations there to take advantage of that tax rate. But I do like this thinking where you can move the levers on a range of settings to make New Zealand a much more attractive place to invest and solve our infrastructure deficit.
Okay, so the initial reporting, which you referenced from RNZ, that's one thing. But obviously this idea needs to be fleshed out a lot more. But it sounds like it's probably going to be accepted as a common sense, I don't know, economic, political, it bundles up a whole lot of things. For the average person, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? That's really what I'm trying to get to.
When you've got an infrastructure deficit, yes, it does. When you've got opportunities to invest in infrastructure, it also does. And I mean, certainly as investors, we love the Infratil model where they scour the world for some of the best infrastructure investment opportunities and allocate money into it. And as I said, I mean, that business, the stock price is up 150%, yeah, I think, over 5 years.
Not bad.
A small dividend as well. So infrastructure in this day and age is a great investment. It's also been a very reliable investment.
What are some of the areas, just curiosity, that Infratil are into in New Zealand that would maybe surprise people, that make them go, oh, I didn't realise they were involved in that?
Well, one of their largest investments here is, of course, One New Zealand.
Ah, yeah.
I think we've heard of them. Yeah, the large telco provider. And the other area that may or may not surprise people is they own about two-thirds of Wellington Airport.
Oh, two-thirds.
Yes. The other, 66%, I believe, and yeah, the other 34% is owned by the Wellington Council.
Well, they've been agonising over that, haven't they, recently?
Well, they sure have. I think they wanted or needed to sell it to raise funds, and there were possibly members of the council who didn't think those funds would be used well, so have voted against the sale. I mean, their particular share would be worth $280 million, $290 million, okay, something like that.
Yeah.
And I did have a look at some of the spending of Wellington Council, and they spent about $280 million on cycleways, removing cars from the city, a food scraps recycling program. So in that context, I'd probably rather have the airport shares.
No, surely the food scraps recycling program is trumps everything, Simon. You know.
Well, they've bought food scrap bins here in Auckland. I've yet to use mine because I'm not generating sufficient food scraps.
Well, here's a fun fact. My grandfather was the chief surveyor, head surveyor on the Wellington Airport runway project, okay, for the Wellington City Council back in the day. That's what they did when they came back from the war. They built useful things like airports. And if anyone notices, there's a slight dip in the runway of Wellington. It goes down slightly. That's his claim to fame. He surveyed that, okay?
And he's left his mark there.
He did a great job. But here's the thing. I don't think he would ever think it was worth, well, over $1 billion later on in life, the whole thing. They probably couldn't even conceive of a figure that big back then.
Would he want his council owning it, or would he prefer to see it in the likes of private hands like Infratil?
He probably would have thought if they're incompetent, they shouldn't have anything to do with it. And I could see why you would block a sale if you're worried how the money's going to be spent, because look at the track record.
Yeah.
So he'd probably think that way. I'm second guessing. I was only 5 and a half when he died, so
I see.
I don't know. But I would imagine, because people were sensible and practical back then.
They sure were. We need more of that common sense approach back today. And, I mean, I think the other thing with the Future Fund is, a couple of weeks ago when we spoke, this whole argument of capital gain seems to have resurfaced. Well, we, in trying to invest over many, many years in things like infrastructure, well, the last thing you need is a capital gain.
It's the whole point, isn't it? It's the whole point.
It's the whole point. To get a capital gain. Investing outside of politics, the last thing you need is to have your investment capital taxed. Yeah. But we keep circling round and round on this from the left, from the legacy media, and I just, the more I hear and the more I put my ear to the ground, most Kiwis would, they don't want a capital gains tax. They want it about as much as they'd want syphilis.
Yeah, well, probably they'd want it even more or less than that. I think you're right. You wonder why people keep talking about it. Is it a good time, because you just touched on airports, to talk about aviation? Because aviation was probably the most disrupted industry during the COVID time. Everywhere, completely, right?
Yes. I mean, airports like Auckland Airport had been a great investment. We'd invested in another company that had invested in a Southend Airport in London, adding another airport there in a key part of the UK. The company that owned that particular airport went into liquidation, because what you saw with COVID is this kind of perfect storm of airports essentially being unable to operate, and also shortly after, interest rates suddenly ramping up to try and get hold of all the inflation from money printing. And if you had debt on an airport and were unable to raise capital, you were in a spot of bother.
Yeah,
tailspin. The good news, it was a predicament. But the good news, Paul, is aviation is back. It's not fully back in New Zealand yet. I think we seem to be lagging 6 months behind the rest of the world. But one company we do follow is EasyJet.
Yeah, low-cost carrier UK.
Low-cost carrier based on the London Stock Exchange. I used to use them quite a bit in my days of working in offshore finance. We were in Jersey. And also a friend of mine had a little 73 Piper, and we'd take that up over the island. Yeah. And then air traffic control would inevitably say, oh, you need to get out of the way. You need to move somewhere else, because we got the EasyJet, the A320 from London coming in.
Yep, and get out of the way.
Several flights of those each day for a small island. But look, that company flew 95 million passengers in 2019.
God, that's like a continent's worth.
It's a lot of people. Yeah. And a lot of our wholesale clients, they say, well, why are you investing in airlines? That's a risky, low-margin business. And then I say to them, well, hang on, the way EasyJet operates, it's almost like a power utility, like an electrical company, because it's servicing, well, before the pandemic, 95 million people. Now, of course, what happened during the pandemic is that airline was essentially grounded. The share price crumbled. But now, going into this financial year, we're going to be probably back over 100 million passengers, so even more than before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And the share price is up a tidy 33% in 1 year, and we're also looking to bring the dividend back. But we're not seeing quite the same progress through Auckland Airport, another business we invest in. I think they had about 21 million passenger movements before the pandemic, and they're tracking to sort of be on about 18.5 to 19 this year. So still a little way to go, but they are, of course, looking to invest in that domestic jet terminal.
Yeah, I think Air New Zealand's parked some jets, and they've been facing some pretty tough competition from, you know, the likes of Emirates, Qatar, Malaysia, everyone that sort of goes through Australia.
Yeah,
seems to be stealing, you know, customers. Even the American airlines flying down here are dirt cheap. Air New Zealand's never been, you know, a discount, put it that way. So we've got a bit of catch up to go yet, obviously, here.
We do. And what I'm also hearing from people coming from offshore is we're still 6 months behind in terms of getting back to how we were before this pandemic hit us.
We've always been 6 months behind, haven't we?
Well, especially in this case.
In this case, always it's 6 months.
Yeah, but I think in this case, the restrictions and the money printing and the response we faced was more aggressive than many.
Just getting back to EasyJet, They're big scale, obviously, then passenger numbers speak for themselves, but they have a huge fleet of aircraft, don't they, which means that they can, across their fleet and their network, they can bring the per-seat cost way down, right? That's how they do it. Obviously, having quick turnarounds and relying on the whole piece parts of all the machinery bits working properly, but that's how they do it. The smaller you are, the harder it is, I would have thought.
That's right. So this is a business that operates at scale. Their average revenue per seat is clocked up at about £70 of revenue per seat. So that's the total revenue. They've then obviously got all their costs off that. Fuel is looking reasonably positive at the moment with the falling oil price. But yeah, it's a business at scale. It's a business we quite like because it's simply the risk is spread over, well, this year, 100 million passengers, and that's quite a customer base. Now, of course, Paul, I must remind listeners, anything we cover here isn't advice.
No, that's fair enough. Yep.
But listeners, do go out and talk to a financial advisor. If you're wondering about investing in airlines, you do really need to do your homework.
And also just reminding me, I'm sure I read it somewhere or heard it somewhere, speaking of wealth funds and infrastructure funds, and Winston quoted Singapore, and I believe that one of the first investments that that fund made way back in the early 70s was the setup after the Malaysian separation, the setup of Singapore Airlines. Now look at what Singapore Airlines have done for Singapore.
Yes, and also crucially, the movement and then the development of the new airport at Changi. Consistently rated the best or the second best airport in the world. One I fly through very often. My wife was born in Singapore. Just a fantastic, easy, functioning airport. And it is sometimes disappointing to come back to Auckland and just see the amount of work that needs to be done. So I was pretty happy that they are doing this capital raise, which has just completed, $1.4 billion, to actually go ahead and build that new jet terminal, which I think is going to be over $2 billion. But that investment will see them eventually having 27 million passenger movements by about 2033. So it's a good quality growth asset, in my view.
The only thing with Auckland Airport, it's forever road cones and works underway. It's like it never stops. One day, please, just even for a year, just stop working on it, you know.
Well, it's a work in progress.
I know, but it can be annoying.
It is good to see an asset that's growing. More airlines want to fly there. And look, it's the gateway to New Zealand. 75% of international flights come through there, and I believe about 90% are long haul.
All Palmerston North, though, are fighting back. They're putting $40 million into their terminal. Watch out.
Well, I look forward to the day when I can fly in on an A380 from Singapore to Palmerston North.
Only in a dire emergency. If Ohakia is fogged in, maybe, and you're right out of fuel. All right, just conscious of time, let's move on to breakthroughs that drive market growth. We must be due for some kind of breakthrough.
Well, it's interesting. We follow an analyst who drives to work every morning in the Silicon Valley area of California. And he said, well, when breakthroughs start appearing on billboards, you know they might be getting a little tired, a little long in the tooth. He said, all the billboards on the way to work, they used to be cryptocurrency. Now they've all, in recent days, they've been AI.
No surprise.
Intelligence. And you kind of sense by the time they're on a billboard, the zeitgeist is probably moved. And investing in them directly may not be your best bet. Problem with AI, as my colleague puts it, it's very intelligent. It's the world's smartest five-year-old child.
Yeah, nicely put, yeah.
There's going to be limitations as to what it can do. So as investors, we're actually looking at, okay, you've got some smart chips here. Okay, they use a lot of power. You've got some technology. How can it actually transform business revenue or create new streams of business? And where we're at the moment, one area we particularly like is autonomous vehicles. So Waymo, the Google self-drive business. I believe they're currently doing about 100,000 autonomous trips in about four US cities. And I think many of your listeners would have also seen the CyberCab come out.
Yeah, wasn't that a looker? Crikey, something out of a movie.
Absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. No steering wheel, no pedals, induction charging, under $30,000 US. And he's hoping to have a fleet of those ready to go in 2026. Now, we were worried about the impact on the Uber business, but they are making noises that they may have autonomous driving, an autonomous driving solution out by middle to late next year, 2025. So it's all moving. I mean, it's going to completely transform the margins and price on an Uber trip. But of course, the big question people have is, what about the 5 million people in the US alone who are employed as drivers or in other transportation?
Yeah, think about that. Yep.
You've got to think about that. But I keep coming back to the fact that we have an aging population. We don't have enough babies. We don't have enough kids. Fertility's well under the 2.1 replacement, even in the US, even with all that immigration, still below replacement. So we actually have a shortage of labor, not an excess of labor. So I think if autonomous driving does take over in a big way, it will be a case of, well, instead of being a truck driver, go be a carpenter or operate a data center. There will be simply other opportunities, and the market will help direct people.
Elon's also showcased his latest robots. Did you see them? They look like they could do carpentry.
Yes, I have seen them, and apparently there was a party where they were serving drinks, where they were making cocktails.
That's right.
Although there did seem to be some reporting that they may have been human directed, or perhaps even some of them were humans dressed up. I'm not sure.
Like C-3PO. All right. I saw a video the other day, and it was the Long Beach port. And you know, that is run by AI now. Just autonomous machines pick up the containers, put them in the right spot, stack them up. Then the crane comes along, talks to the other bit of the AI, lifts it up, puts it on the ship. And we're dozens and dozens, maybe even hundreds of, what do you call them, stevedores, port workers, were employed. Hardly anyone to be seen. So there you go.
Yeah, but we're still not seeing a big increase in unemployment numbers. So it does seem like we've still got critical shortages and the market's directing people elsewhere. But maybe AI is getting smarter, Paul. Maybe that comment about a five-year-old child, well, maybe it's up to a nine-year-old already. Yeah,
even worse.
It's only going to get better.
Imagine a 14-year-old.
Could be concerning.
And I can imagine the person who can't work out why they always fail at investments until it clicks that they've been following the freeway advertising billboards. They click. You know, oh, it's that. Got to come up with a new strategy.
Yeah, well, wouldn't that be interesting? Your AI autonomous taxi driving by the AI billboards on the way to work.
And they also displayed, I think, the cyber truck or the cyber rig at a German truck show, and it just outperforms everything. What's induction charging, by the way?
So rather than a cable, the car would simply sit on a plate and charge from there. So presumably, Paul, after it's taken you to Queenstown Airport for your next trip, there'll be a wee induction plate there and it'll sit on that and be charging ready for the next customer.
Okay, so no huge plug-ins and all of that sort of carry on?
No cables, no.
Okay.
No cables to trip over.
EasyJet don't fly out of Queenstown. What am I going to do?
Well, Queenstown Airport, I believe, is about 25% owned by Auckland Airport. So there are connections all around.
All right. I'm sure that market has some expansion to go yet. So don't follow the billboards. That's more of an American thing. Gosh, there's so many of them too. Yes. Last time I was there, a lot for lawyers.
Right.
Get up there. Okay. I think you're right about the autonomous. It's more than just vehicles. It'll be autonomous transportation eventually, no matter what, full stop. There'll be big ships with no one on them.
Yeah, well, especially in the trucking industry, you know, you've got long-distance trucking in Europe and across the United States, and to have that AI automated makes it hugely more efficient.
Yeah. Gosh, being out on the road might be a lonely affair in the future. Like, I actually saw someone today, you know.
Yes, well, maybe in the back seat with the tinted windows and your app listening to RCR.
And some robot serving, I don't know, accoutrements.
But I just find it so exciting, Paul. It creates wonderful investment opportunities and it helps free up our time and maximize the time we do have here.
Yeah. People are going to lose the art of driving, eh? Steering wheel, like, what's that thing? It's a steering wheel. Oh, look it up.
You know. Yeah, well, it makes me sad. I mean, I love driving. I love my cars and I love a good road trip. I've driven from the Lake District in England down to Rome, Italy, and enjoyed every moment of it. It wouldn't quite be the same with an AI driver, but no doubt I'll be able to give you some commentary on how he or it or the five-year-old child inside drives.
Yeah, yeah. No one can remember what a clutch does anymore, that's for sure.
Well, I do like a manual vehicle, but yes.
You used to have an old Fiat and you had to double the clutch, you know, like in and out and then in again.
Fun.
Yeah. Well, it's like a choreography to it, you know. Anyway, always good catching up with you, Simon Angelo, Wealth Morning. If people want to get in touch, Simon, what's the best way they can do that?
Jump on our website at wealthmorning.com. My colleague John's got a free ebook that you can get hold of there. Is Your Wealth in Danger from China and the BRICS? Wealthmorning.com. You can get it there. Paul, great to talk to you.
Yeah, we'll talk again in a few weeks, Simon. Thanks.
Look forward to it. Cheers.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.